This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Buddy, thank you so much for listening. Welcome to Fruit Loop Season 2, Episode 9. If you are listening to our banger intro and twerking to it, I hope you enjoyed yourself. We thank you so much for listening to our show. I love our theme song, so I just wanted to shout it out. But by the way, Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are white. No way! Get out of here! Are you serious? There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we don't hear. Oh, whoops, sorry. My soundboard. Whoops. That we don't hear or know much about because the media and entertainment, they leave all those details out because the news is racist. Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists.
No.
Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Mm-hmm. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294. And we might feature it on a future episode.
Can't wait to hear from you. So, Beth, who are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about the Dayton Christmas killings carried out by a bunch of teenagers and young adults. Laura Taylor, Marvallis Keene, Heather Matthews, and DeMarcus Smith, who called themselves the Downtown Posse.
Ooh, can't wait. So, before we get into the story, how you doing, Beth?
I'm good. I went to see a concert this week, which I haven't done in a long time. Ooh. I was invited by a friend, and I wasn't really looking forward to it because I was imagining the concerts of my youth, and I'm getting too old for that nonsense. But the band was...
Oh, sorry. Whoops.
Would you stop farting?
I need to give that a rest.
Bam!
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. So sorry.
All right.
Okay. I'm out of control. I'm sorry.
Okay, so the band was OK Go, and it was amazing. It was more like a show than a concert. Mm-hmm. So the idea was their idea. The first song that they ever played on TV, they had to lip sync it because they didn't have the equipment to record while they were playing. Mm-hmm. So instead of pretending to play instruments and lip syncing, they decided to make up a dance. So they did this choreographed dance for that show. And mm-hmm. on this show that I saw, they kind of did the opposite. They would have their videos playing in the background, mm-hmm. and then they would play their song. So it was like kind of a reverse of lip syncing. Mm. And they also did one song where they did lip sync and also did a choreographed dance that they did in the video. So that was funny. And they also took questions from the audience. And at the end, they had all the kids Yeah. And at the end, they had all the kids in the audience come up on stage and dance to a song. And it was super fun. And if they come back, I'm definitely going again.
Oh, man. Oh, I am a huge OK Go fan. And their videos, when they first came out, were revolutionary because they were so low budget, but they were so fucking awesome. So when I heard you were going to this show, my head literally exploded. And their songs are so uplifting and positive. And I can only imagine how good it would feel to be like in the midst of this band. I'm so excited that you went.
Yeah, it was fun.
It looked like a lot of fun. But me, this has just been, we're just getting ready for Christmas mode. We're trying to get little people in my home who believe in Santa Claus to continue believing. And so that's where all of my energies are focused right now.
Yeah. You know, I sometimes have nightmares that it, like in the middle of the summer that it's Christmas and I'm not ready yet.
Oh God.
Like the next day is Christmas and I haven't bought any presents or I have nightmares. Yeah.
Yeah. We had our company Christmas party on Friday and people were like, "Are you ready for Christmas yet?" And I was like, "I have not bought one damn
Fuck
present
you.
Yet.
No, I'm not.
Hey, give me a break. No, I'm not ready yet. But I will get there." So
I hate when people ask you on like December 1st, "Are you ready for Christmas?" It's like, no.
Just got done with Thanksgiving, sir. Stop.
No.
No, I'm not.
So speaking of Christmas, I wanted to mention that we'll be taking a break for a few weeks for the holidays, but we'll be back in the new year with more stories for you.
We will. And we'll miss you while we're gone.
We will.
We hope that you will be back with us when we return. So now we are going to get into our mailbag.
The angels are here. Yay.
So, what lovely listener letters do you have to share with us, Ben?
Well, Rachel on Facebook said, "I just discovered your podcast. I've binge listened 8 episodes so far."
Wow, 8.
Yeah. "I like your chemistry and the subject matter. I myself am a Caucasian lesbian, and I laughed my ass off about your lesbian mom joke you said on an earlier podcast."
I don't remember what we might have said.
I think it had to have been after we talked about the Hart family. And then I think an episode after that, you said something about how what's the alternative, getting adopted by 2 white lesbian ladies, something like that.
Oh my. Sometimes I say the wildest stuff. Sorry, I forgive. Hey, I'm just going to ask you and the Lord to forgive me for the foul shit that I might say. Anyway, thank you, Rachel.
Well, she laughed her ass off, so it's okay. Okay. And then she said, "I also respect you putting out content about non-Caucasian people out there. I absolutely agree with you. If you're not rich, good looking, and white, your story probably will not all be told. Mm-hmm. Everyone's life has value and meaning. Thanks for reading this and keep up the good work."
Thank you, Miss Rachel. So
yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for listening and rocking with us. We got a nice little message from my gal on Instagram, and her name is Else666 on Instagram. So, hey, boo, by the way, she said, "Just found this podcast. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. 3 thank yous." You guys are awesome and so pleasant. Black Girl Notes rock. I know. And heart emoji. So thank you for rocking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. All right. Well, now let's take a quick break and we'll get into the story when we get back. So we would like to invite any listeners who have a business to advertise to do it with us. For more information, please email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com or check out our website at fruitloopspod.com. Well, thank you. We're back. We're going to get into the subject. And would you like to introduce the individuals that we will be discussing?
Certainly. from December 24th through the 26th, 1992, mm-hmm. six people were killed and three people were injured in one of the bloodiest killing sprees in Dayton's history, which has become known as the Christmas Killings.
All right, now we are going to get into my favorite part of these true crime stories, which is the stats. Here we go. All right. Speak their names because they are important. The victims were Joseph Wilkerson. He was 34, an acquaintance of Taylor, who we'll get into the people involved later on. Danita Gallette. She was 18 years old. And she was a mother using a payphone at the time of her death. Richard Maddox was 19 years old. That was Taylor's ex-boyfriend. Taylor, again, you will find is a very important part of the story. Sarah Abraham was 38 years old. She was a convenience store clerk. Marvin Washington was 18 years old, an acquaintance of the wackos involved in the story. And Wendy Cottrell, 16, was also an acquaintance of the nutsos in this story. Four people were convicted of these killings. Marvallis Keene, he was 19. He eventually was executed. Heather Nicole Matthews, she was 20. DeMarcus Maurice Smith was 19 years old. That was Matthews's boyfriend. And Laura Taylor was 16, and she was Keene's girlfriend at the time. And the killers were two black men, one very bold-ass black girl, and a young white girl. And the stats on the killers are pretty straightforward, but Dayton, Ohio, I think we should know a little bit about before we get into it. As I've mentioned in the past, I don't know shit about the Midwest, but here's what we discovered.
So currently, Dayton, Ohio's population is 140,000, with 55% of the population being white. And the 1990s, it was 180,000. As late as 1990, five General Motors plants employed more than 20,000 people regionally. At the time, the cities were well populated, but once the city felt the effects of the Great Migration, that's black people leaving the South to move north and west to flee racial violence and seek opportunity. Economic growth due to industry and white flight to the suburbs, the cities changed.
Prior to that, Dayton in 1966 experienced race riots. Dayton was established in the 1790s. Guess who lived there before that and who they took the land from? It was Native Americans. It's a sad part of the history that we don't often discuss, but you'll hear about it on Fruit Loops. The city, like many American cities, mandated housing segregation, which crammed about 60,000 black residents into ghettos with neglected schools and discriminatory city services. America, I think we've heard this tune before. One particular beautiful morning, a black man was sweeping the sidewalk in front of his apartment. And as he was doing so, he was blasted in the face with a shotgun by some white guys
Holy
in a car.
Shit.
And this, the city erupted after this. There were riots, there was looting, there were arrests, and even the National Guard had to be called in. So it was crazy.
So Dayton is not that different today. It is the 14th most segregated, largest metropolitan area in the nation. The Great Miami River, which separates east from west, black from white, rich from poor, represents a cultural divide. The lowest performing schools, the blacks, and poor population looks the same as it did in the 1960s. Dayton, Ohio, like many cities in Ohio, was one of the stops in the Great Migration, where black people could find jobs and segregated housing. Dayton's west side is 99% black. The wealthy side of the town is, guess, 98% white.
Yeah, that's pretty stark.
Yeah, it is very stark.
So it was a booming city, and innovation led to business growth. It is considered the birthplace of aviation, as the Wright brothers hailed from Dayton, Ohio. And currently, Dayton is the sixth largest city in Ohio. Dying to go there. Just kidding. So now we're going to get into the early life, at least what we were able to discover about the early lives of the people involved. And as we mentioned before, there's a lot of information about Marvallis because he was painted as the mastermind, but I don't think Beth and I don't see it that way. So
we'll find something different. Mm-hmm. The four young people who went on this killing spree in Dayton, Ohio, referred to themselves as the Downtown Posse and consisted of 16-year-old Laura Taylor, 17-year-old DeMarcus Smith, 20-year-old Heather Matthews, and 19-year-old Marvallis Keene. Three others in the posse who did not participate in the crimes were Wendy Cottrell, 16, who was pregnant at the time, Marvin Washington, 18, and Jeffrey Wright, who was 28 or 29, somewhere around there.
Okay. Marvallis Keene was raised by his mom, Bernice, who was a Black woman. Marvallis, pronounced Marvallis, and you, I heard on a podcast where they were like, I'm just going to call him Marvallis. Well, that's not his name. That's not his government name. That's not the name his mom gave him. Anyway, his mom used to call him Valley, which was cute. She stressed working hard and getting a good education. Growing up, he was involved in a youth group. He sang in the church choir. And she raised two sons. Marvallis's brother was named Maurice. And welcome to Culture Corner with Beth and Wendy. And I wanted to point out Marvallis's name. Now, people often comment or poke fun at Black people and their unique names. And it's true. Black people do the most when it comes to naming offspring. They do. We know it. And not one person in my family has a regular name. I think personally, and I could be wrong about this, but I think it goes back to slavery. Enslaved people were given names by their slave masters. They could not choose their names or even keep the names that they were born with. So even every time a slave was sold, they might change their name. And I think ever since then, Black people have made it a point to give their children strong, unique names. Plus, Black parents also try to instill this idea into their children that Black people's ancestry was royalty, and they named their children accordingly. So just my two cents.
Thank you for that. So back to Marvallis, mm-hmm. which I do keep thinking in my head, Marvallis, and I have to try really hard not to say Marvallis.
Okay.
So if I slip, I apologize.
Yeah.
So, Marvallis's father left when they were really small. Actually, I heard on one podcast that he actually left the day that Marvallis was born.
Oh, no.
I know.
Sad.
So their mother did divorce him eventually when she realized he wasn't coming back. And then she married another guy. And the boys had a good relationship with their first stepfather. But eventually that marriage ended and Bernice married a third man who was an abusive alcoholic. And that marriage dissolved and Bernice married a fourth time. And I think the boys had a good relationship with him. And they did reconnect with their biological father who was living in California, raising a new family with three other kids. By the way, Marvallis's father was white.
That's right.
So he lived in a white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Marvallis attended high school and made decent grades. Again, he was involved in his church. He volunteered there. And in the early 90s, Maurice Keene, that's the brother of Marvallis, was lured by the streets. At a party, a drug deal went wrong, and Maurice was killed after being shot three times. Marvallis was very close to his brother and was deeply affected by this loss.
So after that happened, Marvallis had trouble in school and he dropped out of high school. Mm-hmm. His mother, he was just despondent about his brother, and his mother sent him to California to live with his dad. Mm-hmm. Marvallis graduated from high school in California, but then his maternal grandmother died. And Marvallis had trouble making friends in California. He and his dad got into a fight about finances, and Marvallis left. He moved back to Ohio and he was staying with his mom, but eventually left her home a couple of weeks before Christmas. And we don't know why, but that's what happened.
That is what happened. So he worked at a nursing home, I read, and but after all of this and the move and leaving his mom's house, he began drinking very heavily. And when he would get drunk, he would rant about his brother's death, because nobody was ever arrested, tried, or convicted, imprisoned for the death of his brother. And he joined some other young people and runaways who partied and smoked crack together.
Sometimes the young people would crash at various crack and or trap houses. And I wanted to ask you, what's a trap house?
I am so glad that you asked. because our theme song is trap song. It's a trap themed right. song. A trap is where you make your money, but you never, ever really make enough to get out. So a trap house, I mean, we could call our office the trap.
That's a trap house.
Yeah. Just very simply, it's where you make your money. So okay. If making the money is selling drugs, if it's selling your body, that's the trap.
Okay, cool. Or not mm-hmm. cool, but...
Yeah, it's great.
Good to know.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, there's some other lingo in here that I might have to ask you about.
Okay.
So Marvallis would get faded and rant about how unfair life was and how angry he was. To flex, he told his peers that he was a crip in L.A., but actually he had never been in trouble with the law. He was fronting for sure. People say Keene was very polite, but he liked to floss. He liked to brag. So what's flossing?
Flossing is showing off.
Okay. That's what I figured, Ben.
And flexing is the same. It's
like flexing your muscles.
Yes. What else might we need to explain? Getting faded. That's when you get really drunk or high.
Right.
And Crips are a famous gang in L.A. And they, what color do they? Blue. Crips are blue. Bloods are red. Crips are blue.
Crips are
and
blue. Yeah.
Crips have really fun dance moves and gang signs.
But Marvallis had nothing to do with the Crips in L.A. Absolutely nothing. He was just
nothing. But
bragging.
He told people, well, I'm from L.A. and I was a Crip, but he was totally lying.
Yeah.
So Laura Taylor was a 16-year-old black girl. She was involved in this posse. She dropped out of high school. She was a runaway. She sold drugs and she sold sex to get by and survive. And she was very street smart.
Heather Matthews had just gotten out of prison and was addicted to crack cocaine. She was white. Matthews was a truant, a chronic runaway, and a high school dropout. She was released early from the Ohio Reformatory for Women at Marysville after serving 6 months of a one-year sentence for receiving stolen property.
DeMarcus Smith was 17 years old, and we couldn't find much about him. So if you are listening to this and you know him or know of him, please fill us in on the details. Yeah. And then there's Wendy Cottrell. And she was the 16-year-old white girl who was pregnant. And her family did not like that she hung out with and was dating a black guy. So she ran away from home.
Yeah. And she was pregnant with Martin's baby.
Mm-hmm.
Or not Martin, Marvin.
Right.
And I think that was the impetus for her running away from home. She knew her parents would not be happy about that.
Hmm.
So, and Marvin Washington, Wendy's boyfriend, he was 18. We also don't know a whole lot about him. Actually, we know nothing about him. So, yeah. Again, if you know anything about him, give us a shout out.
You know where to find us.
Or I hope you do. Sometimes the posse would stay at the apartment of a guy named Bill McIntyre, whose home I've heard referred to as a crack house. Bill sold the kids drugs and would let them crash at his house sometimes.
Thanks, Bill. most of the stories we've read and heard paint Marvallis as the ringleader. Now, I think that Laura was actually the one cooking up all these ideas and doing much of the dirty work. She had a baby face, street smarts, and she was a survivor girl. I'm a survivor. I'm not going to give up. And Marvallis really, really wasn't a survivor to the magnitude that she was. I mean, he lied about being in a gang. We will later find just shot people in the face. So, potato patata, but they were not the same
caliber.
Yeah, caliber of leader.
Right. So Laura and Marvallis met after he left his mom's house. They stayed on the street, did drugs, and even had enough money from Marvallis's job to stay in a hotel for a few days. But they ran out of money on December 23rd.
All right, so here's where the fuckery ensues, and we are going to get into the timeline. So take it away, Beth.
So in December 1992, downtown Dayton was filled with holiday decorations and activities. There was the Christmas tree lighting on Courthouse Square, and across the street, the Dayton Arcade had reopened temporarily with pop-up shops and eateries for the holiday season.
Oh, do you hear those sleigh bells ringling, ting, ting, tingling too?
Ching, 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 ching. Sleigh bells
ringing. Yeah.
Are you listening?
Yo, I have to pause because we did do Christmas carols at our Christmas party, company Christmas party, and Beth had these harmonies that were like Destiny's Child Beyonce level, like. I can't even repeat it. And I get paid to sing sometimes, but I had to look over at you and I was like, dang,
what the hell is she doing?
That is a good one.
I thought it was funny because we were up there singing with, you know, a bunch of other people. 10 people maybe?
Yeah, about 10 people.
Yeah, about 10 people. Looking out at everybody sitting at their tables, and they were all, it looked like they were all like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
I got that impression too, but then we busted out the remix from the
company song
party, yeah, 20 years ago, and everybody's like, whoa. So then people got it.
Then they got a little more lively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, just that is a super tangent, but Beth, whew, you got some pipes. back to the story. The downtown posse were estranged from their families and looking for trouble. Oh, yes. Laura Taylor is quoted as having said, let's get some drama in our lives. Oh, yes.
And who, boy, did they.
But did she not hear about Mary J. Blige and the No Mo drama? Anyway, on December 24th, 1992, Marvallis Keene and Laura Taylor enlisted Heather Matthews to help them rob Joseph Wilkerson. He was 34 years old. He was an acquaintance of Taylor's, and Wilkerson worked for General Motors, and he was actually doing pretty good economically.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder how she knew him, like maybe through her sex work. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because Taylor told Matthews that she had arranged for the three of them to go to Wilkerson's house, and she'd promised sex with Wilkerson and the three of them. So, but the real plan was to rob him. And Matthews agreed to take part in the robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Keene, Taylor, and Matthews walked to Wilkerson's house. And after a drink, Wilkerson and Taylor went to the bedroom. After waiting briefly, Keene and Matthews followed them. Wilkerson began to take his clothes off, and Taylor and Matthews pretended to do the same.
Quite diabolical. Keene began to remove his own pants, but then he pulled them back up and he drew a gun. He ordered Wilkerson onto the bed, then commanded Taylor and Matthews to tie Wilkerson's hands to the bed. While Keene watched Wilkerson, Taylor and Matthews went through the house looking for things to steal. They took a microwave oven. Now, this is 1992. So they took a microwave oven, a TV, which probably was big as hell, a cordless phone, a curling iron. Oh, yes. A blow dryer, which they loaded into Wilkerson's Buick. Wilkerson told Keene that he kept a .32 caliber Derringer in the garage. That's a gun. And Keene found it and brought it back to the bedroom. Keene then shot Wilkerson in the chest with the Derringer after covering him with blankets to muffle the noise.
So Taylor and Matthews, hearing the shot, returned to the bedroom and saw Keene holding the Derringer. Wilkerson's feet were shaking, so they knew he wasn't dead. Keene handed the Derringer to Taylor, but it would not fire again. So Keene gave Taylor his own gun, and Taylor shot Wilkerson in the head. Wilkerson then stopped shaking. The trio then loaded up the stolen goods and left in Wilkerson's car. Keene told Taylor and Matthews not to tell Cottrell and Washington what they'd done. They then went and picked up Heather's boyfriend, DeMarcus Smith.
Hey, DeMarcus, want to come hang out with us? It's Christmas Eve.
We got all this stuff we stole from a guy we just killed.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. Santa came. So later that evening, Danita Gillette, 18 years old, took a walk after spending time with her family on Christmas Eve. How lovely. She was a student and a mother of a 2-year-old daughter. And Danita was from a very large family. I think she had more than 5 siblings. I want to say 8 or 7.
Wow.
And she lived with one of her brothers. They spent Christmas Eve together. And after dinner, she walked around the corner to use a payphone. Remember those days?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. I used to use a payphone a lot. But I would dial 1-800-COLLECT. And when they would say your name, I'd call my parents and I'd say, please pick me up as my full name.
I had a code name.
Oh, you did?
When I would call my parents. Yeah.
On collect.
Yeah. Samantha Smith.
Oh, and then they would know?
Yeah. Well, they would know to call me back because when I lived in college in the dorm, and that's when dorms were like really bare bones. Nobody had a telephone. Nobody had a TV, nothing like that. So the only phone was a payphone in the hall. And so I would call my parents and they had the number for the payphone. I would call collect and say it was Samantha Smith or say, ask for somebody and say it was Samantha Smith. And they would say, oh, they're not here right now. Call back later. And so then I'd hang up and they would call me right back.
Oh, that is very clever. See,
that was a little tangent.
It was a little tangent. So welcome back to the story. Keene, Taylor, and Smith were walking by when they saw Danita Gillette at the public telephone. Smith decided that he wanted Gillette's Fila tennis shoes. So Smith and Keene drew their guns, and Smith forced Gillette at gunpoint to take her shoes off, saying, Merry Christmas, bitch. Smith and Keene then shot Gillette, and they stole her shoes, jacket, and backpack.
All they found in the backpack was 50 cents. Jesus. Police found her body on the ground outside the telephone booth, shot 5 times. The pavement was covered with blood and 25 caliber blazer aluminum bullet shell casings. Danita was transported to the hospital, where she died shortly after arriving. The group drove Wilkerson's stolen Buick to Bill McIntyre's apartment. When they got there, Taylor was wearing Gillette's jacket and Smith was carrying Gillette's shoes.
It's almost like they didn't realize that they were committing crimes. They were just really enjoying themselves, it seems like.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Really enjoying themselves. That same evening, Jeffrey Wright, he was 28 years old, arrived at Bill McIntyre's apartment. Jeffrey Wright was the ex-boyfriend, but some documents I saw, like court documents, said that he was the current boyfriend of Heather Matthews. I don't know. But he was upset to find Heather there with DeMarcus Smith. Should say that these were young people. They were hanging out on the streets and surviving, ingesting substances, and it was not uncommon for them to have romantic and sexual relationships that would begin and end amongst each other all of the time. So Heather may have been messing around with DeMarcus Smith at the same time or shortly before or shortly after.
Right. So Jeffrey and Heather got into a fight. Jeffrey grabbed Heather by the hair and started dragging her. DeMarcus Smith saw this, and then Wright and Smith fought. Smith took out a gun, and Wright saw it and ran out of the apartment, which is exactly what I would do.
Oh, yeah.
Smith took off after him and unloaded the clip in Wright's direction. He shot Wright 4 times, but Wright was able to limp over to a neighbor's house, and he survived. Keen, Matthews, Taylor, and Smith took off in Wilkerson's Buick. And then on December 25th, Marvallis Keen returned to Wilkerson's house. He stole more items, including Wilkerson's other car, a Pontiac.
Boy, this couldn't last. It would be, they're just doing too much.
yeah.
Too much.
Too much in a short period of time.
This is 3 days that this all occurs. In very, very close proximity, these events are happening. So, only a matter of time. Also, on Christmas Day, Laura contacted her ex-boyfriend, Richmond Maddox. He was 19 years old. And again, Laura was, I think, 16. She led him to believe that she wanted to hook up with him. But she really planned on robbing him. And he picked her up in his car, and they were supposed to be going to a hotel.
Mm. But he noticed as they were driving that a car was following them. It was Marvallis Keen and DeMarcus Smith, following them in another car. Maddox became suspicious and gunned the accelerator. Taylor then put a Derringer to his right temple and fired while he was driving, and she was in the passenger seat. And that's just nuts.
That's like movie Tom Cruise stunt type of stuff. That's insane. It's whoa, girl. Crazy.
Yeah.
Whoa, girl. The cojones on this one. Laura then jumped out of the moving car before it crashed. Again, that's not something you do every day. She hobbled away. And Marvallis Keen and DeMarcus Smith picked her up in Wilkerson's stolen Pontiac.
At first, police thought Maddox was killed from the car crash. But when he got to the hospital, the doctors found a bullet in his head. Police questioned witnesses who said they had seen 2 black men. And I have here that they were standing near the car, but it could have been in the car. In any case, they saw a couple of black guys.
Call 911. Just kidding.
There's some black men on the street. Call the police.
Yeah. Remember that 1-844 white fear, WYTFEAR. Call it before you call 911. If you see a black person doing something regular before you call the police. Anyway,
yes.
Early in the morning on December 26th, the downtown posse was looking for more people to rob. Matthews drove the Pontiac to a BP service station where Kathy Henderson was filling her tires with air. They pulled a gun and Kathy ran. Good. They fired at her, but she was not hit. Keen and Smith then drove off in Henderson's car. Matthews followed in the Pontiac.
And when it says early in the morning, I think it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So later that morning, Matthews drove the Pontiac to the Shortstop Mini Mart with Keen, Smith, and Taylor in the car. The location was Laura's idea. She knew only a few people worked there at a time, and that it was isolated and would be an easy target.
Again, this is why we think Laura is the actual ringleader. Yeah. Taylor went into the store and bought a soda, and she was a nickel short, and Edward Thompson, who I've also seen referred to as Jimmy Thompson, another customer, gave her the nickel so she could buy, you know, her drink. And then Laura went back to the car to report that there were only two customers inside. Matthews handed a .32 caliber revolver to Smith, and Smith and Keene were also carrying 25 caliber automatic pistols. Man, they got a lot of guns for these kids.
Yeah,
and Keene and Smith went into the store.
Sarah Abraham was working behind the cash register. Abraham was from Ethiopia. She was the mother of three children. Her youngest daughter was in the States with her. Her two older kids were back in Ethiopia. She was educated and had been in the States for 15 years. Abraham's family owned the store, and they had spent their entire life savings to open it.
At gunpoint, Keene ordered Abraham to open the register. Abraham did so and removed $44, which she handed to Keene. It's not that much money, guys. Is it worth it?
No.
Keene then shot Abraham in the face. I heard she was shot in the mouth and in the head. Several days later, Abraham died of her wounds, and Smith also shot at two other people in the store.
Jones Pettis was shot in the hand and the stomach, but he survived. 71-year-old Thompson, the guy who had given Taylor a nickel, was shot at. He was not shot, but he fell down to the ground and pretended that he had been shot, and he also survived. Both Thompson and Pettis were able to give police a description of the shooters.
At this point, the police were starting to put the pieces together. So hip hop air horn for the police. I don't give you guys this very much, but here you go. Okay, and they realized that these crimes were connected because of the ballistics, specifically the .25 caliber blazer aluminum bullet shell casings.
Marvellous Keene and DeMarcus Smith were starting to get paranoid. I imagine that there was some media attention to these crimes. Mm-hmm. And so they started switching up cars that they were driving, and they started changing the license plates. But they were especially paranoid about Wendy Cottrell and her boyfriend, Marvin Washington, who had not participated in the crimes, but they knew about them.
Right. And as we mentioned before, the downtown posse included Laura Taylor, DeMarcus Smith, Nicholas Woodson, Heather Matthews, Wendy Cottrell, Marvin Washington, and Jeffrey Wright. All of them, except Jeffrey Wright, had been to Wilkerson's house to drink and hang out. Wilkerson's dead body was in the back bedroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
What's that movie? Something with Bernie?
The one
where they drag the dead body around everywhere?
Oh, I'm not familiar.
Weekend with Bernie or Weekend at Bernie's.
I have never seen that movie, but I didn't know that that's what it was about.
Yeah. I forget exactly what happened, but their friend Bernie died, and then they drag his body around, pretend like he's still alive.
Oh, Lord, have mercy on all of our souls. I didn't know that was a thing. Oh, no. Yeah.
And I can't remember why they had to do that, but yeah.
That's oh, God. I did not.
So it was Weekend at Wilkerson's.
Weekend at Wilkerson's. Woo-woo. Merry Christmas.
But Jeffrey Wright had been shot. Taylor and Matthews started discussing jumping Wendy Cottrell. Smith also said that he was going to unload a clip in Marvin Washington's ass.
Sorry, I like that sound.
Smith thought that Wendy and Marvin were going to snitch about Smith shooting Jeff Wright. The group discussed picking Washington and Cottrell up and taking them to a park or something.
Are you familiar with the term jumping, Beth?
I thought it meant like beating them up.
You're right. Yes, we're gonna jump her. We're gonna kick right. The shit out of her. Yes. Woodson was starting to get paranoid about the possibility of the group turning on him too. So when they went out for a drive and drinks later that evening, he said he was tired and asked to be dropped off at home. Bye, guys.
Yeah, and I also wanted to mention that to drive home the point how young these kids were, Woodson lived with his parents. Yeah. So they dropped off Woodson at his parents' house and then drove to a gravel pit. At the gravel pit, Smith ordered Washington out of the car and Keene dragged Cottrell out. Washington and Cottrell protested that they had not gone to the police or snitched.
They never said a word. The two begged and pleaded and said they would not ever snitch and had not told the police one damn thing, but Keene and Smith forced them at gunpoint to walk behind a pile of gravel. There, Keene shot Cottrell and Smith shot Washington. Wendy was shot in the face and in the back of the head. Marvin was shot several times in the torso and in the back of the head. And Marvallis and DeMarcus stole the jewelry off of the dead victim's body. There was two of them.
Yeah, that's pretty awful.
Yeah, it's pretty low, guys. I've never done crack, but it really does seem like it's a hell of a drug.
That's what they say.
All of these extracurricular activities. So now we're going to get into the investigation and arrest. So what do you got for us, Beth?
On the afternoon of December 26th, Nicholas Woodson was so freaked out about this crazy-ass posse that he called the police. He told the police they talked about robbing and killing people. He spilled all the tea. The people killed, including Wilkerson's dead body, the car stolen, their plan, and everything. Woodson told the police he was in fear for his life and the police brought him in for his safety.
So now the police knew who they were looking for and the vehicles they were driving. Later on December 26th, former Dayton Police Sergeant John Hubber spotted a stolen car on Colmer Avenue. Colmer called in the plate to check it, and when registration didn't come back to a Dodge Shadow, units closed in from all directions. At the time, Hubbard did not know that he was stopping Dayton's spree killers. Way to go! Way to go! So you know what? Nice job, officer.
After so much violence, the gang's capture was actually fairly uneventful. Smith did run into a nearby house, but was quickly captured, while the other three, Keene, Matthews, and Taylor, were taken into custody without incident.
Quote, they all cooperated and put their hands up. I later found out from the detectives that Laura Taylor told Marvallis Keene to shoot me and he wouldn't, said Hubber. Police confiscated several weapons. They found Danita's jacket and Wendy's jewelry. They also found a pocket knife belonging to Joseph Wilkerson.
After the four members of the posse were behind bars, Taylor got a visit from a local minister who was concerned that she was only 16 and accused of such terrible crimes. During their visit, Taylor told him about two more victims, and police found the bodies of Wendy Cottrell, 16, and Marvin Washington, 19, in a city-owned gravel pit.
Oh, boy. So Taylor's insolence in the face of serious charges shocked the detectives. Shocked us too. One of the detectives called Laura Taylor a cold-hearted killer. She lawyered up real fast, but the remaining three did not, and they told the police everything. At trial, prosecutors painted Keene as the ringleader, but detectives believed Laura was actually the catalyst for the spree. Same girl, same. All but Marvallis were ineligible for the death penalty because they were minors.
Keene admitted to his crimes and waived his right to a jury trial. Instead, he had a three-judge panel and was found guilty. Keene's defense team cited PTSD for the death of his brother, the abandonment from his father, and his immaturity. The court acknowledged these things, but they did not buy it. citing that he had a hardworking, church-going mother who raised him and cared for him. He had no criminal record, and he didn't. He had nothing, not even a speeding ticket.
Not even a parking ticket, right.
Yeah. But at the same time, he had killed 5 people in 3 days. So they said, no, girl.
No, girl. Not today. Not today, Satan. So Heather gave up the most details when she spoke to detectives during a prison interview in 2000. Where is that Dateline episode? Heather Matthews explained why she got into the crime spree. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to do what they was doing, Matthews said. She later claimed that she didn't do any of the actual killings, but she didn't stop them either because she was too scared. I don't know.
Homicide detective Doyle Burke said that once the killing started, he believes that they were all willing participants. They enjoyed it. They lived it. It made them somebody, Burke said. Said Dayton Police Sergeant George Hammond at the time, they were like a shark. Once they tasted blood, they couldn't stop.
So, that's a great soundbite, but they were kids. I don't know if it was really clear to them exactly what they were doing. We'll get into that later, I guess. So where are they now? I'll tell you. Clemency hearings are routine in capital cases, and inmates usually make a plea for mercy. But Marvallis did not. He declined even the standard death row interview with a parole board member to make a case for clemency. At his request, his defense attorneys offered no argument in favor of clemency. At the time, Rachel Troutman of the Ohio Public Defender's Office said he doesn't want to cause his family and the victims' families any more pain than he already has. Wow. Shout out to you.
Yeah. And on July 21st, 2009, Marvallis Keene was executed by lethal injection at 10:36 a.m. at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville. His last meal, and you know I'm all about the last meals.
Hey!
His last meal was a porterhouse steak with A1 sauce, a pound of jumbo shrimp with cocktail sauce, French fries, onion rings, dinner rolls and butter, 2 plums, a mango, a pound of seedless white grapes, German chocolate cake, 2 bottles of Pepsi, and 2 bottles of A&W cream soda. And I also found out that he had his last meal, it was the day before. So I always wondered about that. Like, when do they get their last meal? Is it like right before they get killed?
That's what
Oh,
he had it the day before.
Yeah, I guess the night before his dinner.
Wow. I'm just saying, all of that stuff would probably give me diarrhea.
That's a lot of food. He probably didn't eat all of it.
Wow. 2 bottles of each of those sodas. Oh, me, oh, my. Wow. But yeah. Good choices. I can't fault you for that.
Yeah, can't fault you for your choices.
No. Well, at least not the food ones.
Right. So, the killing ones, not so much.
Well, those are questionable. I wouldn't have done them. Wouldn't have been my idea of fun, but all right.
But a porterhouse steak? Yeah, I'm all down for that.
Yeah. I'm with you. I'm with you there at least. So, Keene was the 1,171st execution and the 1,000th by lethal injection since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. Asked if he had any final words, he said, "No, I have no words." None of his family attended the execution. Some of the victims' family members did attend. Laura Taylor, she is currently serving a life sentence in the Ohio Reformatory for Women in Marysville for her role in the Christmas killings, the Dayton crime spree of 1992, and she is not eligible for parole until 2098. Oh sport.
Yeah, she's never getting out.
No.
DeMarcus Smith is serving a life sentence at the Mansfield Correctional Institute for his role in the Dayton Christmas killings. He is not eligible for parole until 2123.
He got more time than Laura did.
Laura did.
Which is weird to me.
Yeah, that is weird.
But guess why? Because black men always get sentenced. Dark-skinned black men always get sentenced.
Yeah.
And anybody else.
And men in general, I think, get longer sentences than women, usually. Heather Matthews is serving a life sentence at the Ohio Reformatory for Women in Marysville for her role in the Christmas killings. And her parole date is 2132.
Wait, whoa! That's later than everybody.
That's even longer than DeMarcus. And
she's a white lady.
Yeah, and she didn't kill anybody.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Oh, no. The injustice of it all.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, her mother said, I thought she changed. I really did. And this was about her daughter after she'd been released for her first incarceration before the killings began. She said her daughter was a follower. Like the old saying goes, if somebody jumped off a bridge, she'd do it too.
Love you, Mom. Thanks.
Jeez. Of course, she is in jail for a killing spree. So, you know.
I know. I don't know if anybody's going to cape up for you. It's got to be your mom.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I guess it kind of was in a way because she's saying it wasn't her idea. She was just a follower. Mm-hmm. She was just following along.
Okay. I'll take that.
So
I receive that. I am keeping that. And then
I don't know if I buy it, but I receive it.
I'm listening to you. I see you, and I'm going to move on now. Now, the when we're talking about where are they now, great, we heard about where the posse is now, but what about the victims? What about their families? They killed quite a few people and left many people in their wake. So the victims' families relied on each other throughout the trials, sentencing hearings, and up to even beyond Keene's execution. Sarah Abrams was survived by her brothers, Sam and Solomon. She had a daughter, Desta. And again, I think we mentioned she had two boys who were still in Ethiopia. Wendy Cottrell's mother, her name was Donna. Her father and stepmother were Donnie and Rita Cottrell. Were left behind. Richard Maddox was survived by his parents, Eugene and Marceline Maddox, and his sister, Yolanda. Jones Pettis and Edward Thompson survived the shooting, and they were helpful during the trials and also in identifying the shooters. Joseph Wilkerson was survived by Christine and Floyd Wilkerson. His brother, Bill, and his daughters, Lorena Wilkerson and Deborah, I didn't quite get the last name. I want to say Oxidine, but I don't know if that's right. And then Marvallis Keene, his mom was Bernice Parker, but she lost her one son to that murder before Marvallis went on his spree. And then she lost Marvallis to these crimes and his subsequent execution. So
yeah,
not sad. A lot of winners here.
No. And Rhonda Gillette, Danita's sister, admits that even after 25 years, the holidays are still very difficult. She said, I grieve for my family, but I continue to grieve for the other victims' families and also the people who are incarcerated. Anybody's life can either go to the left or the right, so I do. I think about them very often. Gillette said the murder of her sister had a huge impact on her life. The crime led to a breakup of her engagement, the loss of a child, and her mother. 6 years later, my mother passed away prematurely, said Gillette. My mother passed away at 51 years old, and she passed away because of grief. My mother absolutely died of a broken heart.
And that's really sad. Gillette is now an advocate, thank you, for victims' rights and is working on her master's degree. Shout out to you, Ma. She said she gets through the holidays by serving her church and feeding the homeless. Rhonda helped raise her sister's daughter, Dominique, the two-year-old who Galette left behind, who, again, she was 2 years old at the time of the murder. And a book called The Christmas Killings, 40 Hours to Justice, was written by retired Dayton police officer Steve Grismer and Detective Dennis Murphy and Dr. Judith Monsieur. And I'm just going to say, these are all three white people who wrote this book. So I am sure that it's full of facts and insight about the investigation and the detectives, but I don't know if they have the ability to capture the nuance involved in the victim's side of the story.
I'm pretty sure that... it doesn't. I heard on another podcast, they interviewed them, and the focus of the book is on the investigation.
Yeah.
So it's like from the perspective of the police officers and the detectives investigating the crimes, which it's still interesting.
Sure.
But it's not going to,
it might be there's this meme going around of Oprah tasting this white lady's chicken that she didn't put any salt.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah. She's like, could you use some salt?
I'm sorry. I just like
the pepper. The white lady's like, you can salt at the table.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't believe that she did that on TV. So anyway, from this book, might be lacking salt and pepper. I'm just saying.
Yeah. So full disclosure.
Full disclosure.
And we didn't read it. No, so, we didn't. Because there wasn't enough.
There wasn't enough salt and pepper. And that's why I'm not interested. Yeah. but there it is. If you want to pick it up, I'll send you the salt and pepper in the mail. What made the posse snap? I'll tell you what I think. So Laura, in my opinion, had to have had a really hard upbringing to end up doing sex work and involved in drugs like crack, which is a hardcore fucking drug, at age 16. This was the 90s, so I wouldn't be surprised if she saw the same behaviors that she did modeled by her own close, maybe family members. This is speculation here because we couldn't find a lot about her. But the crack epidemic did a really strange thing to the Black community. It not only tore families up, but it also destroyed the dynamic between adults and young people. It flipped it. So adults were like needy children and irresponsible and, addicted, sick, and the children had to figure out how to survive on their own. I think that's why Laura had her street smarts. I mean, she must have had no choice but to engage in the way that she did.
Right.
Now, Marvallis, he was just broken from all the things that he lost: his father, multiple stepfathers, his brothers, his grandmother. And while it sounds like he had a very strong, loving mom for him, maybe it just wasn't enough. It often isn't enough when the dad isn't around. And the narrative doesn't change even though mom is home and showing you love. What about my dad? This is in my head, Marvallis asking, what about my dad? Why doesn't he want me? I'm not saying a single mom can't raise a good, strong, upstanding male citizen. I was raised by a single mom, but his upbringing definitely was a factor in his behavior.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times our society focuses on the moms and what the mom did, and everything's the mom's fault, or, but the kid's relationship with their father is just as important.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of dads, just when they just take off, I don't know what's going through their heads, because Kids need their dads too.
Don't they know so, how much they are needed? You know.
So anyway, yeah. So my thoughts are, I think this was kind of like peer pressure in the extreme. Mm-hmm. I think about when I was a teenager. Of course, we never went around killing people, but I know I did a lot of really stupid things following what other people were doing, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And Laura was the instigator, I think. And Marvallis, I think, was lost mm-hmm. and didn't really know where he belonged. Mm-hmm. And when he hooked up with Laura and her group, suddenly he felt important. Mm-hmm. He bragged about being in the Crips, and they all thought he was a badass. And he kind of had to keep that front going. Mm-hmm. But something else that amazes me about this story is that he and Laura had only known each other for 2 weeks.
Whoa! Oh my!
Isn't that nuts?
Well, yeah. When you're young, nuts. 2 weeks, can't 2 weeks seem like a lifetime?
It seems like 2 months at least. Yeah. It does. Yeah. So I wish we knew more about Laura's life. I really do. Yeah. I looked and looked and looked, and I couldn't find much of anything. Mm-hmm. And Heather and DeMarcus, too, for that matter. Yeah. Couldn't find a whole lot about them.
Yeah.
The news articles are all about Marvallis. And I think part of that might also be because he had never been in any trouble before, and all of a sudden he's in this posse and they're killing people. So I think that might be some of the fascination.
Yeah.
But there were three other people involved in these crimes, and I don't think that Marvallis was the worst of the bunch.
No, and we only know about him. Since you brought up belonging, I'm just going to bring this up because there is a common theme in mixed race individuals. Like Marvallis, who was half white and half black, this idea of being lost and never, ever fitting in. And one of the archetypes in black literature, in black life, is the tragic mulatto, which Marvallis would have fit into. The person who never quite fits in with black culture, never quite fits in with black culture, and anybody that accepts them, that's who they're running with. I'm mixed race too, so I totally get it. But I just wanted to put that out there because I don't want to leave any stone unturned in this story.
And I didn't think of that, and that's a really good point.
Yeah, you just brought it up, and it came to my mind. So now we're gonna get into our takeaways. This bunch, they were an equal opportunity murder bunch. They did not really discriminate. Most of their victims were black people, but that, I think, has to do with, you know, where they lived. Again, we talked about how segregated Dayton is, and the places and people that they had access to. If they were on the other side of town, best believe somebody would have been calling the police right away, and they wouldn't have murdered anybody. they started out, I think the motive was robbing people, but they really didn't rob that much stuff in value. They didn't get that much money. They only took a couple cars. But then the motive became this joy killing. Once they killed that first victim, they just couldn't stop. It was so tasty. It sounds like it was also a terrifying time to be in Dayton, Ohio, given how random these murders were over the holidays. And that is not lost upon me. So I do want to put that out there. But it just had to have been a really scary Christmas and a not so happy New Year.
Yeah. So my takeaway is, it really shocks me when people as young as 16 kill, let alone six people on a killing spree. Mm-hmm. But I have a problem with juveniles being charged with adults.
Yes.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. The human brain isn't fully formed until we're about 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And this is why teenagers often make horrible decisions, especially if they've had a terrible home life. Mm-hmm. I think each case should be considered differently. And if rehabilitation is at all possible, that should be the goal. Often these kids who are tried as adults are later let out on parole mm-hmm. when they are much older and they've been institutionalized and hardened. Mm-hmm. The U.S. is not big on rehabilitation, but it's real big on punishment.
Oh, yes.
And if people are going to be released later, if that's going to happen, then it's not helpful or good for society to release these people who've been institutionalized. That said, mm-hmm. I really don't know if Laura could have been rehabilitated. So
maybe not.
That's why, I think every case should be considered differently.
You know? Yeah.
Take everything into consideration.
I know several convicts. One comes to mind. His name is, we call him Convict Jonathan. Jonathan was locked up when he was 13 and released when he was 23.
Wow.
And he still acted like a 13-year-old. It was like he never had the opportunity to grow.
He never grew
as
up.
As a human. He never grew up. And I don't know if he ever will. I mean, I don't want Convict Jonathan coming to my house anytime soon. I mean, I'll see you at the next family event, Convict Jonathan. But he's a child. But he's a child who's been harmed by the criminal justice system. So,
right.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about how not to get murdered. Even if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you. All right, let's do it.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. But in my mind, this is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
Okay, so, Woo, wake up, Wendy. sorry to your coworkers who might be listening to this podcast. It is the holidays, y'all, and it is also robbing season, so be on guard. I recommend a security system. We've talked about this in the past. There are some alarms that you can stick on your windows and doors. You can get them at Lowe's or Home Depot. And you can also get fake security system signs to keep, you know, intruders at bay. Also, beware of dog signs are a good way to keep intruders at bay. This is sad. But most people who are stealing are doing so because they're poor or they need to feed an addiction. And they want the easier route. So if it's between your big ass dog or your beware of dog sign or the house that has nothing, you know, in front of it, they're going to go with the easier one, right? A step above that may be like a security system. Like Simply Safe. I think Simply Safe is a really good system because they're not a sponsor of ours, but you know, you guys can get at us. You know how to get us at Simply Safe. Please do sponsor us. But it's a really neat system because you can set it up yourself. There's no contract. You don't have to have a convicted felon come into your house. You know, like if your phone line were to get cut, you know, like from one of those horror movie scenes, the service is still operable. And these killers essentially were ambushing their victims. So in the store, you know, they killed somebody. At a party, they shot somebody. At a payphone, they killed somebody. Somebody was filling up their tires and they shot at them. So I recommend just be aware of your surroundings, especially at this time of year, and be careful when you go to a gas station or a convenience store. Don't get out if it's dark and it's a questionable scenario. In my neighborhood, I don't have any, I know what it is. There's some gas stations at nighttime. I'm not getting out of my car or stopping at that place. So just everybody, head on the swivel, be aware, be safe. Happy holidays.
Yeah, something I noticed about this story was that some of the victims, like Danita Gillette and Kathy Henderson, were out late at night by themselves. Mm-hmm. If you have something that you need to do, like fill up your tires or something like that, try to do it during the daylight hours when there are lots of people around and it's not dark.
Yes, amen. So now we're going to get into the part of our story where we get into some serial killer or true crime news. So what do you got for us, Beth? Anything juicy?
Well, while researching this case, I saw an article about a soccer coach on the run from Ohio because I was looking at an article on an Ohio newspaper.
Oh, okay.
So he was on the run from Ohio after being charged with multiple counts of sexual conduct with a minor.
Oh, no.
Sexual battery by a coach. Sexual imposition stemming from allegations he had been sexually involved with a 14-year-old
girl. Oh, no. Stop. Oh, no.
Yeah, this guy was 41 years old. Stop His name it. Was Justin Smith. He was of Germantown, Ohio, and he was actually on trial in Montgomery County when during a break after he had testified in the proceedings on October 31st.
Okay.
He escaped. He cut off he had an ankle monitor. He cut it off and just took off. But he was arrested the other day on December 14th in a townhome at Fort Walton Beach, Florida.
That's good.
Smith had been one step ahead of the authorities and using cash and burner cell phones to evade arrest. But it was his use of a dating website that finally led to his apprehension. What a pig.
Do we know which one?
I'm not sure. It just said a dating website.
Okay.
But this was his downfall because a woman that he was communicating with on that website cooperated with local authorities in Florida. She looked this guy up and found out who she was talking to and called the police.
Shout out to you, Ma. Way to go with this.
Yeah. Smith has been charged as a fugitive from justice and transported back to the Okaloosa County Jail. So when I saw the link to the article, I didn't click it. And then later I was like, I'm going to look that up. So I went to find it. So I Googled soccer coach arrested.
Okay.
And a whole bunch of stories about soccer coaches molesting kids came up.
This is concerning. Whoa. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh my. Yeah.
So watch your kids around those coaches, folks.
You really cannot.
The boys and the girls.
Boys and the girls.
Yes. Well,
Nasser, the Penn State guy. I work with a guy who played football at Penn State and so proud to have played with Sandusky. And I'm like, dude, that's not good.
What is wrong with you?
I don't care.
That's nothing to brag about, man.
I don't think we should be bragging about that. Oh, man.
No.
We do all need to watch our kids because this is a culture. I don't want to say anything bad about the church, but I'm kind of glad you brought this up because my news is about the Jesuit priests. Reveal podcast, and I don't know if anybody, shout out to Al Letson over at Reveal. Those guys do some really, really great investigative journalism and uncover incredible stories that actually do lead to change in terms of administrations and in the world that we see today. The latest episode is called Sins of the Father, and it's about Jesuit priests, multiple priests who chronically abused children and young men and women on Indian reservations. The priests, they would get complained about, and then the church would just shuffle them around from reservation to reservation as accusations mounted. And then finally, when there were too many accusations or the priests were just too fucking old, the church would just park the priests in this priest retirement home in the middle of Gonzaga University in Spokane. The news story is bananas. It's a really great podcast episode. And, it's going to make you think, it's going to make you angry, it's going to make you sick, but it's going to also make you wonder, what can we do about this? Because this is Catholic Church is so massive and they have so much money.
Yeah, it's a big problem.
This story comes up over and over again. So,
yeah, it keeps happening again and again and again and again.
And yeah, with the coaching thing. So I don't know, but it's news because it needs to be news. So, so now we are going to get into the part of our story where we shout out any content by people of color, LGBTQ people, or any true crime goodies. So I wanted to give a shout out to the podcast While Black. It's two black dudes, Art and Vince. Vince and I are play cousins. The show is really well done, but it's so necessary. Vince told me that it was, you know, it was clear. I was like, why did you start your show? And, you know, I was telling him why we started Fruit Loops. And he said it was clear to him after the nonsense in Ferguson, that basically people, white and black, were not informed about why Ferguson was the way it was, why people were angry, why these systems were the way they were, why history was what it was. And he and Art created this podcast to educate people. And they had an episode about having HIV while black, code switching while black, policing while black. And my absolute favorite episode was when they had a former prison corrections officer on. Man, he was talking about prisoners, you know, shanking each other in the neck and the gaping holes and all the blood and gore. The blood and gore, I just loved it. The raping, the inner workings of the prison. Like, I loved it so much, I had to listen to it twice. And in general, they bring on experts on a topic from the Atlanta area to discuss these issues from the perspective of somebody of color. It's very well informed. It's a great listen. And if you want to be a better human, aka be more like Beth, add it to your playlist.
So my shout out is, and I've shouted this out before, stay tuned with Preet, but specifically his mm-hmm. December 6th episode. He did a live show with Pakistani American comedian Kumail Nanjiani, who wrote and stars in The Big Sick and is also in the TV show Silicon Valley. Kumail talks about how happy he was when Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle came out, because it portrayed people of color as just regular human beings with mm-hmm. flaws and everything. So human beings.
You know, people with more melanated skin are just regular people.
Yeah. Like everybody else. Just like everybody else. Yeah.
So that was a really great recommendation, Beth. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm a big fan of both Preet and Kumail. The Big Sick is a super duper funny movie. And my favorite joke is he's like talking to his white girlfriend's family while she's like in a coma or something in the waiting room at the hospital. And they were talking about 9/11. They asked him about 9/11. He was like, oh man, it was such a sad day. We lost some of our best guys that day. And like, it was a joke. But white people's face was so full of horror. It was just priceless. So he's very funny and his work is really funny. So I thank you for that shout out.
Yeah, he is. He's really funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a really good episode. I enjoyed it a lot. I think I'll listen to it again. And I also, when he was talking about when Harold and Kumar go to White Castle, and then his own show, he's like, I don't feel like my job is to portray people of color as like great human beings, just the best, mm-hmm. the cream of the crop, or anything like that. It's just to portray people of color as just like everybody else, human beings. And I think that's kind of what we're trying to do too.
I think so too. And I you know, I don't know if anybody, it's a podcast, so you can't see me, but my fist is in the air. round fist emoji. Yeah, I like that. I agree. Yeah. I agree with all you just said. So, Beth, this is so much fun. We went a little longer than we wanted to, but I certainly had a great time. If the people want to have more fun with us, where can they find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone. Or you can find online at cash.me /$FruitloopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help.
That's right. And if you don't want to give us any money, then why don't you give us a great review on iTunes?
Yeah.
So this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.